Oh, man. I can't even do it. I lost my falsetto. I was going to do a Arabic lady yell because this movie has some. Hans Zimmer's favorite trope. A trope we all really liked back in the days of Gladiator. A good 23 years ago. The ethnic warbling lady trope. And then Hans Zimmer did it a bunch in a bunch of things, like Black Hawk Down and other things. And then it became a cliche that people used temp tracks in other movies when they were editing them together. And then the composer had to do his best version of Hans Zimmer's score. I actually like the score to Gladiator. It might be one of the worst scores in terms of its influence on Hollywood. Mm. Like, I thought that was a pretty cool score at the time.
Yeah.
And I think I still like it. But man, it's like the introduction of that generic Hans Zimmer theme, you know, the da 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 da.
It's the Jason Bourne of scores.
Yeah, no, I think that's really true. I think that's a great poll. It's the Jason Bourne of scores. Something good in and of itself that had a terrible influence.
There's Warbling Lady. There's Womp, Womp.
Right.
Womp. And then there's the shaky cam.
Yep. Well, I mean, really, if you listen to the Inception score, it's a great score too. It's not just womp womp. It's got this really nice kind of metronomic Philip Glass kind of theme. It's good. Everybody likes the Inception score. What am I telling you that you don't already know? But nothing.
Yeah, and the Bourne movies were a breath of fresh air.
Yeah, they were.
And yeah, they just ruined everything downstream of them.
Yeah, it's like you go outside, you start breathing fresh air, and then you realize it's cold, the door's locked, you're in your underwear, and you slowly starve and freeze to death because you're in the wilderness. And you don't have a phone in this scenario.
That's exactly right.
Hey, speaking of death.
You don't even know your name.
You don't even know your name. Speaking of death, you don't even know your name. I don't know. What parts of our memories are connected to our bodies? What parts will go with our souls? Interesting question to contemplate. Has nothing to do with Frank Herbert's Dune. This movie has a little something to do with Frank Herbert's Dune, though. It is Denis Villeneuve's Dune.
No contempt in that name pronunciation.
No, I love Dune. I love Denis Villeneuve. I thought it was Denis Villeneuve, but I watched a video with him where he was like, let me expound the great things I was doing in Dune 2, the scene with the sandworm. I wanted it to have lots of sand because I thought it was a sandy movie. All these great insights. Like that, like,
yes.
But he's like, hello, I am Denis Villeneuve, or something. There's a very pronounced F sound in it, proving once again that I do not know how to pronounce French stuff. One of my least favorite filmmakers. Did I like this movie, though? We did a preview episode. I said, you're going to be surprised, because we all hated the first Dune. All right, recap. By the way, this is Sanity at the Movies. I'm Nathan. That's Ben.
Hello.
The preacher who's a teacher of cinema.
Hello.
And we've got the pastor who's a master of cinema right there. It's Jake Menzel.
It's me.
Three avowed Dune haters. One of our most, I would say, across all of our podcasts, there's a couple takes that people have not liked.
Very few takes.
Very few, but
most of our takes everybody agrees with universally.
When
it comes to Winnie the Pooh or when it comes to...
Well, I would say on the Mount Rushmore of takes that people hate, you have Winnie the Pooh, which we liked. We just thought it was maybe a little bit more for adults and less for kids. That's all we said.
That's all we said was it's a little condescending to kids and made more for the adults who are reading it to their kids than the kids themselves.
And boy, did people get out the pitchforks on that one.
Yeah.
We said C.S. Lewis sometimes not as good as other times.
So we have Faces, one of those times where he's not as good as other times.
And the little section where he makes an apology for sodomy in his autobiography, one of those times. That's what we said.
Clearly one of those times.
And boy, did people get
people
out
the pitchfork. People don't like that. Right. Yeah.
Obviously, a modern saint, never did anything wrong, never said anything wrong, had a perfect grasp of theology, even though no one else in his time or place did. So great.
No one else in any time or place did except for him.
Except for C.S. Lewis.
Yeah, the unassailable saint.
The unassailable 20th century. Saint Jack Lewis. So, but yes, so that's Winnie the Pooh, C.S. Lewis. You mentioned another one.
No, I started to try to pull like Alice in Wonderland or something, but I couldn't.
Yeah, remember. I mean, we think What's-His-Face was a bit of a perv, but whatever. Maybe there's not a Mount Rushmore because we don't have four of them. Maybe we don't have the Lincoln for our Mount Rushmore. But certainly in the Pantheon, there are three things I can think of. C.S. Lewis,
Milne.
Milne, and the fact that we did, not none of us cared for that first Denis Villeneuve Dune movie. People were just like, what? You're blowing my mind. You don't like a modern American masterpiece. What? That was how people felt about that. And let me just say, I get it. I get why you like it. It's big. It's epic.
90% of it is the director of photography, whose name I always forget. It's G.
Is it Greg Fraser?
Yeah, Greg Fraser. For whatever reason, the I in Greg throws me off, and I start to, then my mind goes to Gareth Edwards, and I just, like, my brain just cannot pull Greg Fraser, as basic a name as that is.
I get why people like it. It's big. It's pretty. The special effects have weight and depth to them. It feels like you're actually looking at spaceships and stuff. If you saw it in IMAX or whatever, I'm sure it was a very immersive service experience. I think that was during the pandemic. We all watched it on HBO Max. But so that wasn't doing it any favors. I'll be the first to admit that. It takes its time setting the pieces of the story in place in a way that people probably appreciate in the world of frantic, scrambled Marvel sort of schlock. It felt stately. It felt real. It felt big. It felt like a movie.
Yeah, like it was trying to be a movie.
Right.
Instead of trying to take your money.
And we, with our monocles, were like, it's good that it's a movie, but could it also be a good movie? And most people didn't feel like that. They were just like, thank you, a movie. And by the way, it's good. And you're a jerk, Nathan, for saying it's not. It's got a screenplay. It goes from A to B to C. Like, it's got scenes. They're pretty. It's got feelings. People just liked it. Now, why didn't we, if I can stop being a total jerk, what was our actual reasons again for not liking this Dune movie, the first one?
All the notes, but none of the music.
Yep.
It's dry and lifeless as the desert sands.
It's just really boring.
A song.
Yep.
You can use it.
Yeah, it's boring. And I don't think Denis Villeneuve has a good grasp of character. I don't think he has a good grasp of character in the movie we're about to talk about. I think he's actually really bad at it in a way that I find very frustrating, which we'll talk about it. That being said, did we all hate this movie? We all like the book Dune. I guess that's another baggage thing to say.
Yeah, I enjoyed the book.
And Ben and I have read various further adventures of Paul Atreides. And,
Oh, boy.
And they basically are all terrible, but kind of interesting, some of them. Kind of very debauched, some of them. Whatever. Now, guys, what is your point of view? What is our point of view on this film?
Luke, you're going to find that many of the truths we cling to depend greatly on our own point of view.
A new fantastic point of view.
Good is a point of view, Anakin.
Now, we should say, someone in this room liked this Dune. Someone in this room liked this Dune. Maybe more than someone. Maybe some ones. So, verbally, raise your hand if you would give a thumbs up to the idea of this Dune, part two. Myself, I'm going to have to give it a thumbs up. I had a good time with Dune, part two.
Yeah, I give it a thumbs up. One thumb.
One thumb?
Mm-hmm.
That's all I asked for. May your thumb chip.
And chatter. And
chip and chatter.
May the thumb chip and chatter.
I feel a silence. Oh, I've been looking forward to this day. Finally. After long last, Jake can be the bad guy. Jake can be the snob.
I don't know that it's snobbery, but I really don't like this movie at all.
Really don't like it at all. So what's more interesting? Should we start with why we liked it, or should we start with why you didn't? What do you think the people want?
I don't know. You tell me. What do you want?
Why don't we say why we like it first? And then you say why you didn't like it.
All right, let's go.
I mean, if you think that that's setting you up badly.
No, it's not setting me up. I just think that you have nothing to say.
Here's what I'm
wrong.
Well, okay, I don't love it. And I think it has some pretty big fundamental flaws. But I will say what I like. I thought, unlike the first one, which blew the idea of Araskus, pronounce it, just totally blew it when it came to creating a mystique and a feeling of awe about the planet of Arrakis, which was really is kind of important to the whole Dune vibe. And they just ruined it with their dumb PG-13 action scene at the beginning. Like, just like, so these mouth-breathing popcorn eaters can have a little bit of action before we go to Caliban. So they're like, it's Dune, it's the desert, they're fighting. Paul has a vision or something like that. And it's just like immediately, okay, this is boring. I've seen this before. There's no mystery, no mystique, no buildup. Like, hated that. I think that deflated the whole movie for me, just the first 5 minutes. And in this movie, the first 5 minutes really established a cool vibe for Dune. You really felt like the desert. They had this action scene set during an eclipse or something like that. And it felt deserty and kind of magical and mystical and faraway lands. And, you know, it just did that thing that you want where you felt like you were on an alien planet and there was some magic to it. And there was a sort of religious feeling of awe to it, which you want from this kind of thing. And so this movie basically gave me that. And once it had given me that, it's like, I guess I got my money. Or I got my money. I gave my money. I guess I got what I wanted from a Dune movie. And then the first two-thirds of it are the part of the hero's journey that I think is often sort of skipped over or truncated in your general movie. Like the part where Spider-Man is learning all of his powers and then enjoying them. Oftentimes, we have to go through that part really fast so that we can get to Uncle Ben dies and he's on a mission and we can get to the plot. But I really like that part of the hero's journey, the training part of the hero's journey, the self-discovery. You know, it's a fun fantasy to be like, what if I was the desert messiah and I was good at everything and I spent some time and everybody told me how much they liked me and I kept doing thing after thing right and I kept learning things and I failed a little bit.
Kept winning over the people, my doubters.
Right, yeah. Like, that's just a super fun part of the hero's journey.
Kept putting my own self-doubts to rest, being surprising myself sometimes.
Right. And books can take that too far. Like Ender's Game, for example, is just that over and over and over again. Ender's good at everything and everyone else who's not, he destroys. That can get old. You don't want that to just be it. But when it's done well, when it feels like it comes out of a real place of challenge, when it's structured well, maybe the classic example of this actually from our lifetimes is The Matrix, which is such a well-structured movie. And the middle chunk of that movie, when you don't know whether Neo's the chosen one or not, but he's just learning how to like fly and do guns and
kung fu,
and so much fun that even as a kid, when we finally get to it, the famous action scenes and stuff, I'm like, oh, it's making me a little sad. Like, I don't want drama. I just want to hang out in this cool world. Mm-hmm. And that's what this Dune movie gets a lot wrong. We'll talk about that, including bungling the entire third act, which I'm sure Jake will have things to say about. But I really enjoyed the Paul learns to be a Fremen stuff. I thought that was a lot of fun. And I thought it was pretty well done. And Arrakis had a cool feeling. And the Fremen, like, stuff felt real and lived in, which is not something that I felt about. Still in this movie, did not feel about certain other locations in the movie. And don't feel like Denis Villeneuve is actually very good at it for someone who's famous for being so good at bringing these sci-fi vistas to life. But I felt like he was
bringing any vista to life,
right?
Juarez to life.
Yeah, I think he's bad at all of it. I really just think he's a bad filmmaker. But I thought he was at his best in the desert here, and all that stuff was fun. Mm-hmm. There wasn't enough of it for my liking. All the religious sort of stuff was fun, not the stupid jibes at fundamentalists, but the sort of what we got. I would have liked more, but what we got of Rebecca Ferguson becoming a witch priestess was a lot of fun. Drinking the sacred elixir. Like, I like that stuff. That's fun. And so that's basically my entire argument for why I enjoyed the movie. I just had fun with all that stuff. And then everything else was like, okay. But I obviously, folks, I know what Jake's going to say already. So maybe if I was being less disinterested, I could set myself up. I could put myself out on some limbs and then he could saw them off. But I don't know how to do that in an organic way. So I'm just going to say the things that I like. Ben?
Yeah, I think I liked the same things. I just had a good time in the desert, basically. And I thought that scene by scene, Villeneuve directed some fun things and some cool things. Whereas scene by scene in the first one, everything felt like it was lifeless.
Yeah.
And so just scene by scene in the first movie, I was like, I don't care about anything. I don't care about your big action scene. your attempts at them. I don't care about your explosions. I don't care about the cool emotional beats that I remember liking so much from the book Dune, because you don't know how to render them. You don't know how to make them emotional. But in this movie, there was fun stuff. There were the action in the desert was actually pretty cool. Cooler than like the knife fight at the end, which was lame. And then, yeah, the lived-inness of the desert in the Fremen was really interesting, because he was able to make it work as a setting, which I don't know why that is. I don't know. I don't understand what his deal is, but it did feel like he believed in it and he could see his way to telling a story inside it.
It's really when he's at his worst. Well, let me not get there. I'll let Jake lead that monster.
And then I liked Timothy Chalamet this time, at least a lot of the movie I did.
I did too, and I actually didn't mind Zendaya. I thought they were both pretty charming.
Yeah.
I thought everything, as we'll get to, that they were asked to play did not work. But just as charismatic screen actors that I liked watching, two beautiful people that could sit on a dune and make googly eyes at each other, you know, like the most primal stuff that we go to the movies for, I thought they delivered that, actually. Maybe I'm coming around. Maybe I'm becoming a Shalia fan, because I watched Wonka a couple days. And let me tell you, folks, don't go see Dune. See Wonka. Wonka is, I loved it. 4 stars. 10 out of 10. That's an exaggeration. 8 out of 10. It's the first movie that I've wanted to turn around the next day and watch again. And I didn't try it because my wife didn't love it that much. But if she'd been on board, I would have just watched it again, because I liked the music. I thought the comedy was funny. I just think I really just like that dude, the Paddington dude. I mean, everybody loves that dude. But
Paddington movies are great.
Yeah,
that guy's super talented. All right. I don't think I have anything else to say, really. I mean, there was a lot wrong. There was a lot stupid. There was a lot annoying. In the movie.
Which we'll get to. Maybe Jake would like us to say our bad things first.
Go ahead.
Well, okay. I'm happy to do it or not. But if you say go ahead, I'll do it. Villeneuve is just bad with character. Like, he is just profoundly uninterested in what motivates people. So like in Arrival, Amy Adams makes this big decision. Once all the timey-wimey stuff starts happening in that movie, she makes a decision not to tell Jeremy Renner about a pregnancy. She can now see the future. There's a whole thing. I don't even want to bother explaining it. But basically, her character makes a choice, a big sci-fi choice regarding embracing a tragedy instead of turning away from it. And I'm okay with her making that choice, but I have no idea why. I don't know who she was and what made her make that choice. And I hate that. It's really annoying. Same thing for Hugh Jackman in Prisoners. He plays a certain kind of character. I don't know who he was before the big thing that happens in Prisoners happened. I just know that he's just like a collection of behaviors that are unmotivated. And Chalamet in this movie, Paul, same thing. I know why Frank Herbert's Paul Atreides does what he does. Frank Herbert's Paul Atreides basically buys into the fundamentalism aspect of things, at least to some degree. And not that he's as... He believes his own press in terms of being an actual messiah. He understands that that's been engineered, but he's very happy to use it. He's happy to just be Space Hitler for a while. In the later books, he regrets it. But in this book, in this movie, it's like he's supposed to be sort of – it's not even that he's supposed to be conflicted. It's just that Denis Villeneuve doesn't know how to do character or doesn't care to do character in such a way. I don't know whether he's conflicted. I don't know. I just know at one point he's like kind of on board with not being Space Hitler. And then – later, he's on board with being Space Hitler. And this is where
Villeneuve doesn't even know what story he's trying to tell.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the most obnoxious thing about this movie to me.
Right.
I mean, sorry to jump in.
No, go ahead.
But I can actually forgive the first Dune movie a lot of the things that we don't like about it if it's a setup that's going to pay off something. But Villeneuve doesn't know the story that he's trying to tell. He doesn't understand. There are a bunch of different ways to interpret Herbert and to interpret the first Dune movie and to interpret it in the context of the second book. But my goodness.
You can make it the tragedy of Paul becoming Space Hitler.
Yeah, you can make it the tragedy of Paul becoming Space Hitler. You can make it the triumph of Paul becoming Space Moses, who later becomes Space Hitler. You can make it all kinds of things that are awesome and cathartic and show the power of all of these forces at work. You have all these structures of power that are like manipulating and controlling everything, and they have destroyed Paul's house. They've destroyed his family. They've oppressed these people, these desert people, and now you have somebody with superpowers who has the power to lead his people to freedom, and it's going to cost, and he knows that. But there's all this, there's this behind all these sort of like crass systems of power, there's this religious fervor over here that is going to rise up and take vengeance on the emperor and the great houses and everybody that has been trying to manipulate and control and keep the common man down. And there's such universal appeal in a story like that. And what Paul brings as a character is, I don't know, meaning, purpose, excitement, an ability to rally people to a cause that is bigger than them. All these things are visceral and real. How does Hitler become Hitler? That's actually a compelling story. But he wants to play so sideways to it that you don't even understand, like, why anybody cares. And then Chani in the books is like Paul's woman.
Yeah.
And now, but now she's just going to be the sourpuss off to the side who just stands up and stares with her grumpy face at him all the time. And so what, she's the conscience of the movie? Or is she not? Or what? Because
that's fine though.
From an aesthetic point of view, she just plays as like it, you can make her the conscience of the movie, but he doesn't actually achieve it.
No.
Like she's just like the grumpy side character that like you don't understand why she's doing what she's doing. You don't understand why Paul's doing what he's doing. Nothing really makes sense, and then nothing pays off. And so you go to your big fight, and it's like, well, are you going to give us vengeance or aren't you? Are you going to give us a really cathartic fight at the end or aren't you? Are you going to tell us, are you going to give us a point of view or aren't you? And it's like he's at war, like the aesthetics of the film are at war with what he thinks he's saying. And it's like he does not know how to communicate and tell a freaking story in any meaningful way. And then it, because the cinematography is so beautiful, everybody just thinks, oh, this is subtle. And subtlety is nice in a world of ham-fisted. It's not subtle.
No,
it's just trash storytelling.
He doesn't know what he's doing.
Mm-hmm. He has no idea what he's doing or how to tell the story.
Here's what the people will say. They will say, but Jake, he gave you all the pieces. And they're wrong. So don't yell at me. I know what I'm saying is wrong. But what people will say is, we saw each piece of this arc. We saw the decisions. We saw why he made the decisions. We saw that he doesn't want to drink the water, but then he gets put into a position where he has to drink the water. And then once he sees the water, and they will sit there and they will explain to us each step.
I know.
And it would be hard to explain to them then why we say the movie doesn't actually continue. They're like, all the pieces are there. And it's like, yeah, but it's like the science is there, but the art's not there.
That's
right. The score is there, but the music isn't actually there.
Yeah.
The actual feeling of who this guy is and why he made these choices and what these choices represented to him is not
there. We don't know
that.
And this is why I want to say, like, who in this movie do you love? Who in this movie do you hate? Who in this movie are you cheering for? And when you cheer for them, you feel good or you feel bad. Or you have a question. The only person that's likable actually in this, yeah, there are cute scenes with Paul and Chani on sitting on a dune, and it's cute. And the actors bring so much to this.
But it's almost like
thing.
It's almost like Zendaya and Chalamet, however you say his name, are likable.
They're creating
more than Paul and Chani are likable,
right? It's like Stilgar is the only really interesting character in this whole thing, and even then, like he turns on a dime. He goes from being this sort of like charming, charismatic leader of his people who cares for everybody to being a religious zealot on a dime. When people are making fun of it, you know, or laughing at is, oh, you sound El Gabe. Anytime Paul does something, he's got people gathered around and explaining why. That's exactly why how the Messiah would take a leak against a wall. Rebecca Ferguson brings a lot to her role. Javier Bardem brings a ton to his role. Chalamet and Zendaya bring a lot. Austin Butler does a really cool Stellan Skarsgård impersonation the whole movie.
Yeah, but I hate the Harkonnens. I hate everything about how they're conceived in this.
And then you just take your side characters and you're like, oh, who are... It's just so long as I put in two beautiful people to be the... I forget their names. The actresses' names, but... Florence Pugh and Lea Seydoux. So long as I put some beautiful characters, some beautiful actresses in who can convey some sense of gravity and emotion. And we have costuming change them every time. So it
No, but I actually like them. Interest. I think that the movie has the point of view on them. They're just snakes. Like Lea Seydoux's a bad lady working for a cult. She's there to seduce. Like
absolutely.
I get what that character is. I get who the princess is. She's a politician and nothing else. And she's doing what she needs to survive her father, who's a doddering old fool at this point. Like, I understand that. It's like the characters on the periphery have to just play to archetype because you can't sketch them in enough for them to suck.
All I'm saying is when you cast so high, even in those side roles, you get this bonus level of credibility to what you've done when you've not actually done anything.
Right.
And you could have put a nobody in those roles and they would have given you about the same thing, but you put these beautiful, excellent actresses in and they bring both their credibility and they bring a little bit extra to it. And then people feel like you've done something artistic.
No, I mean, you did have the money to buy credibility and it works. Like the movie does actually have more credibility because you paid for it.
Right.
When you put Florence Pugh in that role, it does have an effect. It's not because Denis Villeneuve is such a genius or anything.
Right.
The thing I'm thinking as you're talking is I just think wokeness really is a cancer that ruins everything because we cannot question our own motives as an audience. We cannot think I would be Space Hitler. And I think that just sucks because the movie that I'm really comparing it to, I know it's unfair to compare this movie to the greatest movie of all time, but The Godfather is a movie where we mourn and are sad at the tragic fall of Michael into evil, but also, as men at least,
we understand his fall and we kind of...
Mm-hmm. Not just kind of, we totally...
We take his side.
We totally vibe on the revenge. We are so happy, whether we admit it or not, that he is just wiping out everyone.
It's cathartic. When we get to the end and everybody just, we just boom, boom, boom.
And we like that he's at his daughter's baptism and lying about it, actually, if we're being honest. Like, there's something deeply satisfying about watching someone just be evil. And then the movie comes in with the beautiful sucker punch at the end where you're like, oh, he's alone. He's got this beautiful wife who loves him and she's about to get shut out. And you're like, oh, I really gave myself to Satan with Michael for a second there.
And there now are consequences.
Now suddenly I understand there was death on that, in that, and that this guy has become a monster and it's terrible. And because you can enter into the glory of it, you can enter into the tragedy of it. And that's what great art has done since the Greek playwrights. That's what Shakespeare did. That's Macbeth, right?
Right. It's Macbeth. Exactly.
But this has to, like, we have to have Shawnee as the moral compass. And then we have to, as the audience, assume her point of view. So we can never just be swept up in Paul the Space Messiah. We can never just enjoy the revenge. We can never. There's a very basic audience-pleasing way to do this movie that maybe feels a little bit Hollywood in all its duplicity, but also is just a classic form where we walk through the steps of the revenge, we enjoy it, and then at the end, we pay the price. It's just like what I said about The Godfather. Like, the most obvious way to do this movie is, yes, Paul had to become Space Hitler to wipe out these creeps.
And you don't even have to pay the price in this movie. You can pay it in the next one, which is more or less how Herbert does it.
Yeah, but I think...
But there are a lot of ways to do it.
I think the best version of this movie, there's lots of better versions of this movie. I think the best version of this movie, the one that I would want to make, is the one where you're really excited when he comes back from drinking the water and is impressing everybody and can get the nukes and everything. And you're like, you're with him through all that and you follow every step and you're kind, there's probably like a nagging voice in the back of your head that's like, you shouldn't be doing this, Paul, but also it's awesome. And then at the end, you're like, oh, man, he sold his soul. And now, like, when he says,
and
give him paradise, that should be.
It should land.
It should be like a wake-up call. Like, oh, this guy's not just gone a few steps too far. He gave himself to the dark side, and he's not coming back. And I'm actually, as an audience member, surprised by that. But this movie can't stop lecturing and posturing through the whole second half, through the character of Zendaya enough, and just through the way it's done. And because of that, it doesn't even make sense. We can't even commit to a point of view on Paul because we need him to be this here and that here. And it's like, does the movie think that this was the only way? Does the movie think that he should have chosen destruction instead of this way because this way is so bad? Like, what does the movie actually even think Paul's doing? How are we supposed to feel about this? How does Paul feel about this? It does not answer very basic narrative questions like that. But, you know, the spectacle is overwhelming and people don't want to think that much about it, which makes me sad.
even the simple choice, like if you had just taken the time to talk about the consequences of not becoming Space Hitler, we're going to live among the dunes. We're going to be hunted down by the Harkonnens. We're all going to be obliterated by them, and they'll be the genocidal maniacs who destroy us. Or we can take them all down. We can take down the systems of power that are corrupt, and there's going to be a lot of casualties along the way. But either way, a lot of people are going to die, and so forget it. It's not going to be me and my people. If you just go there, there's just so many ways to do this sort of thing. You just have to actually do it.
You have to actually do it. You have to know what you're saying about the characters, and it could be any number of things. You could make a choice that this is pure tragedy all the way through. You could make a choice that this is pure space opera, adventure, optimist. You know, you could it wouldn't be honoring Herbert, but you could make a very good Luke Skywalker story out of this, and it'd be just fine. It'd be a good movie. But you got to make a choice. And I think living in an increasingly post-Christian society sucks, because what you really want is for all this stuff to be playing against the backdrop in all of our minds of Judeo-Christian ethics, such that even just him walking in on the Baron who's been disabled and stabbing him to death feels like you're really crossing a line, as opposed to, it's like, Tony Stark basically does that. Like, people, characters in movies do that kind of thing these days. It's not a choice. It's not a big moment. It's just like, of course, Paul's taking revenge, so of course he kills this guy when he's down. If you're saying something about Paul, if you're definitely saying, ooh, he killed a guy when he's down, isn't that interesting? Or isn't that cool even? If you're saying anything about it, great. But if it's just a moment in a collection of moments that don't have a clear point of view on them, that sucks.
So what did Villeneuve think he was doing? Villeneuve thought he was giving a perspective.
I think he actually
came out because he did a little video. I didn't watch it. But he did a little video because people were asking this question. And it's all like, no, Chani's the protagonist and Paul's the villain and the bad guy. And it's like,
I think that's great. I just wanted to see that movie.
Yeah, that's not the movie you made. Either you've decided after the fact your perspective is, maybe you thought that was your perspective, but you don't know how to tell that story. You clearly don't know how to tell that story. The reason you have to make this stupid video is you didn't know how to tell that story. You just, like, you didn't know how to do it. You failed. You failed to tell a story that has a protagonist and a villain, if that's what you think that you did.
Yeah, I saw there's a David Lynch quote that the internet keeps sharing that I see. David Lynch, the famous first guy to try to adapt Dune, where he's in an interview and he just says, you make the movie and then what they want you to do is go and talk about it. And what I always think is, watch the movie. I already said what I wanted to say in the movie. If I need to talk about it, then I failed.
I failed.
Yeah, that's right.
And
Denis Villeneuve, don't you understand that you gave us, if that's a movie you're trying to make, you gave us, you chose the more charismatic actor to do a bunch of hero's journey, cool stuff, all the coolest stuff in the movie, and you made us like him, but you didn't make us feel bad about him.
You just didn't. And your protagonist, apparently, all you did was have her stand to the side and make pouty faces at him.
That's right.
Well, so there's like five times he's just like standing there while everybody's kneeling.
And it makes mincemeat of actually the plot logic. Like in the vaguest way, the nerds will say, it had this, it had that, it all made sense. But it's like this Paul, if you actually think about who this Paul is and the relationship with Chani that he has early in the movie, which is supposed to be pretty good, I think.
Yeah.
Why not tell her, hey, babe, I'm always going to love you. But by the way, I got to marry this princess broad. Like, that's just the thing I need to do, politics. Now, maybe she won't like that, but this guy, this particular version of Paul, I believe, because he seems like he wants to be a pretty nice guy. Maybe he's into revenge and stuff too, but also, like, he likes Chani. There's no reason that should be a surprise to her when that happens. Now, Villeneuve might say, I had you in my artistic grip because you thought Paul was a nice guy, but actually he's a jerk. And I'm like, no, you didn't. You were just sloppy. Yeah, I would love the story where it seems like Paul loves Chani. I could really get behind the really dark, like he's just using her for sex and he's actually not a nice guy, but he's a charismatic guy and she likes. I would love the darkest version of the story. I could really enjoy that.
If you had actually done something on the, you don't even have to tell these things. If you had just done something during his little vision quest where you'd shown us a little bit of what he sees
It's really weird how truncated the vision quest is.
Made us feel, you know, I think the real defense for all of these decisions, he has that moment with his mom. He's like not worried about Chani because he's like, she'll come around. I've seen it. Like he's supposed to have seen everything. And now he's got, you know, he's made his decision because he's seen that, how it all unfolds. And he's trying to walk this like golden path line or whatever, however Herbert puts it, all the way through to some salvation. If he had shown us, enough of what you think Paul sees to make him decide to be Space Hitler. There's a lot of ways that you can do that where it's just like...
Yeah, it could be a tragedy that Paul's
if he's changed, like if the vision quest changes him so much that he comes out and is like, not the same person, screw it, I just have to go kill all the guys because for reasons that are explained in the vision quest, I like...
Well, you could also make the movie, you could even go so far as to make the movie, wow, Paul came out of the vision quest and I don't know where he's at. I don't know who he is anymore. Is he good? Is he bad? And then at the end of the movie, you get the answer. But until that time, it's been vague and unclear and you're not sure what's motivating him.
And what's clear is that he's been changed by this and now we have a mystery on our hands.
I mean, one of the best pieces of writing advice that I just always think of is in Strunk and White, in White's little essay at the end, he says, be opaque clearly. Mm-hmm. The audience has to know when you're intentionally withholding information. That you can be very artful and say, I'm not going to tell you. Actually, The Godfather does this all the time. Michael is one of the best characters in all of cinema because Pacino plays him so close to the chest. Like he never shows you, even you as the audience, all of his cards. But we pretty much always know when we're supposed to know what Michael's thinking and when we're not supposed to know what Michael's thinking. And that helps us. And tells us where we are as an audience member in the scene. Like, oh, I don't actually know whether Michael's going to let the brother live. And then, oh, no, he did not. How about that?
It's so easy to, I mean, the hack way to do it, you just have some music and you have like a change of expression on his face coming out of the vision quest, right?
Right.
And then you just create a hack exposition scene at the end where he just explains himself and he says, I saw this and I saw that and I saw this and I saw that. And if you had seen what I'd seen. Even that much would have been less hack than what Villeneuve actually did.
I don't know whether I buy this theory, but I heard somebody, a pundit, say entertainment companies are run by tech bros now. And tech bros don't understand art. They don't understand cinema. What they do understand is that cliches are bad. And so what happens a lot in movies, this person was arguing, is we don't just get basic information that a boring old Hollywood movie would give us anymore. We don't get like the... Well, I love her, but I want to love this person, but I'm too much of a wimp to ask her out. It's like the CEOs of these companies are like, well, we've all seen that scene a million times. We all know that part of the screenwriting formula. So please leave it out. Be more artistic. And it's like, yeah, if you really can be artistic, that's great. But short of being artistic enough to really be artistic, just give us the scene where it's like, this is my motivation. This is why I'm doing this. Yeah. This is how you as an audience are supposed to feel about it. And, you know, I love filmmakers who are more subtle. I love giving the audience two and letting them make four. But Denis Villeneuve is unique among hacks in that he always perfectly calibrates things almost intentionally so that you just don't have this information. And it would almost feel artistic. It almost does feel intentional and therefore like there's some artistry to it.
What it feels like is somebody trying to play the blues who never learned their scales.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Good metaphor.
Mm-hmm. Like, you can hack around in a pentatonic scale but and act like you're playing the blues. And in wrong notes, in the blues, the blues as a genre is very forgiving. You can go off key, you can bend notes, you can play what sounds like a wrong note and sell it. But man, you could... If you're really going to be good, you got to know what you're doing. You have to know all the rules that you're breaking and why you're breaking them. You can't just get up there and just hack around and call it blues.
Yeah, well, in that sense, he feels like the most talented hacker arounder, but it's like he just like, dude, somewhere in there, I need the first chord, the fourth chord, and the fifth chord.
Yeah.
And I need that progression, or it's not blues. It's something, it's just... Or I need you to say, I'm not a bluesman, I'm an abstract artist, and I need you to go that direction. But the one thing you cannot do, the one thing that annoys me to no end is saying, "Hey, ready for some blues?" And then,
and like, then there's no blues.
You come out, you start hitting the triangle.
When you say blues, I think 1, 4, 5.
Right. Now,
and then riff all you want. You want to be Jimi Hendrix. Like, have you ever heard Jimi Hendrix play straight blues? There are recordings of Jimi Hendrix playing straight blues. Dude was a master of straight blues.
Right.
And that's what any actual guitar player, any of the great guitar players, when they talk about Hendrix, say is that he was probably the best blues guitar player they'd ever heard. And that's why he was so good at playing not the blues and so innovative. It's like he knew all the rules. And he knew every rule that he was breaking whenever he was breaking them.
And Denny Villeneuve never feels like he knows the rules that he's breaking. It feels like he's just kind of accidentally.
He's just doing what he's doing. He's just doing his thing.
Well, the other thing that's so annoying about all of his movies, and this one even, though I liked it, this is very annoying, is he is just allergic to climaxes. Like, he hates giving you a satisfying ending. Both of these Dune movies end with lame knife fights, and it feels very pointed, no pun intended, very intentional.
Yep, very anticlimactic.
Or just very stupid, like, I think I'm giving you an awesome knife fight.
Actually, I wonder if it's that. I think that on some level he thinks he is. He thinks he's leaning into realism somehow, which he's not.
I've seen all the great knife fights and sword fights. Like, the one that they should have...
The thing about... Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
Well, I just want to say the best sword fight of this style is from a not very good movie, but it's Rob Roy. Roy has a great sword fight.
Awesome.
Where you just watch these guys, and it's kind of slow and clunky. Like, it's not about Errol Flynn, like, jumping over things and stuff. It's just about, if I was actually sitting there with a sword or standing there with a sword and the other guy had a sword and we needed to kill each other, what would we do? What would our strategy be? What would our... Again, there's different ways you can do this. You can do an awesome sort of silhouette. We're just watching the bodies,
shadows,
the acrobatic. There's a couple of shots in this where you hope that's what when they're against the window, where you're like, oh, maybe it'll just be a little bit more like that fight in Skyfall. It'll just be like this beautiful abstraction. Like, there's ways to do action scenes like that are great. And then there's what I think he wanted to do, which is more the Rob Roy, like, we're in these guys, and more what Herbert does, which is, how do you actually kill a guy with a knife? What's the strategy? Let's get into Paul's head here. Let's think about it.
But you know what? I thought he doesn't even want to give you the point of view of Paul or Fade Rotha. He wants to give you the point of view of the person who is three rows back trying to see what's happening and can't really see anything that's going on.
Yeah, well.
And that's what it looks like. You have so many shots of, like, there's action happening and you're looking at, like, Austin Butler's back. Like, you see Austin Butler's back and you... There's some motion happening in front of him and Paul's on the other side and you can't see anything. It's like, what in the world am I watching? Like,
David Lynch's is much more successful because David Lynch is giving you Paul's perspective. Like,
yeah, it's like, it's clunky and old and you'll laugh if you watch it. The special effects don't hold up, but you at least understand this is character A, this is character B, this is what he's trying to do. Oh, he's trying to trick him. Oh, no, don't do it. Oh, Sting's going for the knife. Like, you understand those basic kind of action things. And this is like, well, these guys are doing something. I'm sure they're very good at it. But
it's chaos, and I'm just back here observing like somebody would be.
But I mean, it's not even like the Bourne chaos. At least in the Bourne style of action or the Christopher Nolan style of action, you're like, ah, man, something sounds like it's really happening that's cool.
If only the camera would hold still, I could see it.
If this stupid editor would let me see
and
it.
Then like, and then you get to The Dark Knight Rises, and you're like, the camera's holding still. Okay, this isn't that exciting
wrong.
After all.
I was wrong. But this is like, we are being very careful and precise in showing you something that just we don't actually think was that cool. Which I'll give the people that love this movie this. He does have a good sense of scale, which a lot of filmmakers don't. He knows how to make things feel big. When they're bombing the Capitol or whatever, that's pretty cool. And
it's cool.
You see it in the theater.
The sandworms, the three sandworms pop up on the screen.
Yeah.
That's neat.
I would say Paul riding the sandworm, very well done. No complaints. Like, that's a good sequence where you feel everything you're supposed to feel. I thought they really missed a bet by not having Javier Bardem actually shed a tear, though. That's what I thought they were going to do, and I thought that was going to be a great little payoff. I like setups and payoffs, but Denis Villeneuve was like,
too sophisticated.
I'm too artistic. Yeah. I did not give you the payoff. He gave a big speech about you never cry.
And he's just going to do it because that's the kind of character he is. Because I like boring things that are less interesting. But I was like, oh, I'm going to be really excited about this. So, like, this is the kind of moment I love in a movie. We set up that he never cries and it's dumb to cry. And then he's going to shed a single tear as he watches because he's, I hate it when there's an obvious moment like that and they don't just do it. Yeah, I like this movie. Pretty good. Had a good time. I don't disagree with any of Jake's criticisms at all. Truth in reporting is part of being a critic. So you have.
If you wanted, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
If you wanted to take a Marxist read on Dune, Paul's a good guy. He's a great guy. But these systems of power are so corrupt and are so corrupting, which of course is antagonistic to Herbert's point of view when he says, it's not that power corrupts, it's that power attracts the corruptible.
Yep.
Right. But you could do a clean Marxist read on this stuff where it's just like, Paul's a good guy who's going to try to do the right thing, but once he gets caught up in these systems of power, it all go bad. It's just as there's so many ways. That would still be a more compelling story than
I really think name the dumbest read possible and like the feminist read. All men are pigs who like to kill each other and women are smart and awesome. That would actually be, if that was done cleanly, that would be more compelling. We'd probably be sitting here complaining about it, but it would be a movie that made sense.
Well, it'd be worth having a conversation. It'd be worth hating.
Right. Like you said something.
Yeah. You had a point of view.
I like those black fireworks.
Yeah, those are weird. There's some fun effects there.
I really don't like the Harkonnens. I've never liked the Harkonnens. I don't like them in the book. I just think they're, maybe I said this in our preview episode. I don't think they make sense for Herbert's world because they are just purely psychopathic in a way where I'm just like, and Villeneuve piles it on when like they've got their little slaves that they're drinking blood from or whatever it is, which maybe is in the book. I don't remember, but either way, you're just like, and they're always killing like their own guys. You can't go a scene without them. And it's supposed to show how evil they are, but it's like, these guys are a liability. If the Emperor right. is as smart as he's supposed to be, which that's another problem with the movie, he's not portrayed as smart.
No, which is silly.
Which is silly and takes away from Paul's victory boring. At the end. Maybe they thought they hired a good actor and Christopher Walken obviously could play a real snake in his prime, but he's well past that. But it's just like these guys would have been killed off a long time ago. Like they are not smart and stable enough to be chess players. In this universe, they're just psychopaths, and this universe actually has no, like, whatever it is that Herbert believes in, it's not just that being purely evil is what gets you ahead. You have to also be smart. It's the whole thing about the Bene Gesserit. It's why they're actually always ahead of things because they're smart, they're manipulative, they use their power, they use their sexuality, they use every tool. And it's like the Harkonnens are blunt instruments and they're boring. And I love Stellan Skarsgård and I like Austin Butler, but I just don't think they were given anything to play. And neither was Dave Bautista, who I also like.
So what you end up feeling is, why haven't when you see the Harkonnens and when you see the Emperor next to what we see from the Bene Gesserit in Villeneuve's version, you just think, why is this such a complicated 1,000-year sowing seeds of religion process to gain control of this universe? It would be really easy for these women to just like,
yeah,
just subvert it and take it over. They could do it overnight. They could own all these people like that. Like it's easy. Like maybe the other houses are an issue because we have Leto Atreides and he's kind of great, which he's not as great as in the book as portrayed in the movie, but whatever. I don't know. It just feels so stupid and thin.
It's just where the cancer of wokeism ruins storytelling. It's like, how many movies do you watch where you're just like, man, the patriarchy sucks so bad and men are so silly and so just given to their primal urges that like, why haven't women been ruling us now for thousands of years? Like there's not enough power here to even stand against. And this whole movie kind of feels that way. Like the Emperor, the Harkonnens, like these guys don't actually feel like major players. They feel like idiots.
Well, even Duke Atreides is, he may be great, but it sure was easy to take him down.
Yeah, it doesn't.
I mean, if it didn't feel as easy in the book, you felt like this was really set up. Like there was some really good plotting. Whereas in the movie, it's like, I don't know, we just had a guy and we just did some stuff, and of course we took him down.
Yeah, it does not feel
like there's no weight.
It really takes away from Paul's, again, just to compare it to the greatest movie of all time, like in The Godfather, you're like, oh, Michael's really screwed. He's taking over this tattered empire. There's all these factions that are against him. We don't know who the traitor is. Like, you really feel like the Corleones aren't going to last. And then he very brutally, swiftly, quickly, and somewhat easily turns the tables. But when it comes, you're not necessarily expecting it. You really feel like they're on the ropes or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But when Paul Atreides has his victory here, it just feels like, oh, cool. Yeah. I'm glad he found those nukes. That pretty much solved his problem. It wasn't because he was so smart or such a great space Hitler, or doesn't really even feel like he needed to do his whole Messiah bit. He just feels like if he had a few of the right people and some of the right resources, he was going to be just fine, because the people he's fighting are morons.
Yep. Yeah. Whereas in the book, you feel, I mean, whatever Herbert's faults are, wheels within wheels, he was good at.
Yeah, the Baron's not much of a character in the book. Like, he's not very well developed, but at least he feels smart. Whereas Stellan Skarsgård, they want to make him into such a grotesque.
He's just a blob.
He's Jabba the Hutt. But even Jabba the Hutt.
Jabba's sophisticated.
Jabba the Hutt's really smart. Yeah, he's decadent. He's a big, fat monster, literally.
Literal slug, space slug.
And it's not that easy for... Or it's not that hard for a woman to finally off him when the time comes. But you understand. You actually understand in the little bit of time that you get to spend with Jabba the freaking Hutt, you understand how he has stayed in power for so long. You do not understand how Baron Harkonnen has stayed in power. You do not understand why Dave Bautista or Austin Butler has lasted even a day, why anyone would put up with them just like getting mad and slaughtering their dudes left and right. And I just think it's such an example of, I probably made fun of this on our preview podcast, but man, what a stupid, oh man, the Harkonnens are evil. They kill their own men. What's this? And you like feel, Denny, it's not that I mind people using cliches or tropes sometimes, but I really mind when they don't think that, like when they're acting like you haven't seen it before. Like the movie wants you to be like, oh, I can't believe it. He just slaughtered one of his own guys. There's no regard for human life. Who is this guy, this bad, this diabolical ruffian?
Darth Vader doesn't just choke people.
Like, yeah, that's been a pop culture joke now for 30 years since at least Empire Strikes Back. And I'm sure it happened in the old John Wayne Westerns before that. Like,
yeah.
We understand. Bad guys do not have the same regard for human life that good guys are. We got it. But this movie just wants to make that point, and then make that point four or five more times. Dave Bautista does it. Austin Butler does it. And it's kind of the old, like, comedy thing of you say something once, it doesn't mean anything. You say something twice, it's just accidental. You say something three times, there's purpose there. Like, if you want, it's not even comedy, it's just in storytelling. If you want people to understand, like, we're saying Paul is nervous, you need three instances of him from spilling his coffee or whatever, because if you have one, then it's just like, oh, that's a thing that happened. If you have two, then it's like, eh, maybe. But if you have three, then everyone knows. So I guess all I'm saying is, if you really wanted to make like a thing out of the Harkonnens have no regard for human life, I actually think you needed to push it even further somehow. Like, you need four more scenes to finally just say, okay, I get it. The big thing with these people is they have no regard.
They literally are animals.
Right. But you have just enough scenes where you're like, ooh, they can really fly off the handle, without enough scenes for either have one or two, so you're like, these are bad guys, or have 10, so you're like, ah. But having six, it's just enough to not really be saying anything, which is just what the weird anti-art of Denis Villeneuve. I like this movie. I had a fun time with it. I'll give it 3 out of 4 stars.
It was awesome.
0 stars.
0 stars. Jake hated this movie. Now, but be honest, Jake. Be honest either way, because maybe the answer is yes. Did you actually hate it while you were watching it? Or was it more like, the more I think about that, the more I hate it?
The first 2/3 of the movie, which were the part that you liked the most, I was okay. And then when it was like, I am Space Hitler now, I was like, okay, I'm here for this. I want to see this. This is what I want to see. Pay off all this wasted time. I have 5 hours invested in this movie now. Now pay it all off.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was ready. And then it was just like, no, I'm not going to do it, actually. And I don't even know what story I'm trying to tell. And I just was like, I appreciated all the same aspects of the first two thirds that you guys did. But I don't know if you're going to make a movie, either have something to say or make it fun. He did neither. And so I'm pretty forgiving when it comes to, I don't know, I don't have anything to say, but here's some fun stuff.
Yeah, usually you would be me. Usually you'd be like, I understand what you're saying, Nathan, that it sucks actually on a like deeply existential level, but
I had some fun stuff.
Worms.
I had fun with the fun of it. But man, if you're not going to have anything to say and you're not going to be any real fun, you're just going to be the kind of movie that is supposed to make me feel like I've seen something smart. Screw that. I have no patience for it. Either give me my candy or give me some steak or get out of my way and stop wasting my life. I have no patience. I have so little patience for a movie like that. I'm happy with candy and I am happy with steak and I'm happy with candy and steak together. But man, it just deny me nutrition and fun.
Well, what you're describing.
And tell me that I'm supposed to feel good about myself for it.
I think you're describing a Salisbury steak. It calls itself steak.
Right.
It sort of has some of the dumb things about steak.
And idiots who have never learned how to enjoy real steak.
Right.
Think that they're eating steak.
But it's not a, like a burger's great. Goodness. A steak's great. A Salisbury steak.
Yeah. Give me my cheeseburger or give me my ribeye. And take your Salisbury steak and feed it to the rats in the dumpster.
Take your Salisbury steak and feed it to the rats in the dumpster. I think we have our poll quote for this episode. Oh, man, I was really hoping we'd have a nice Dune episode for people who like Dune.
I'm the bad guy.
Jake's the bad guy.
I am the hero of the people. I still think, even in this movie, I'm the hero of the people.
I jumped on the sandworm. I'm always actually the hero of the people because I'm always right about everything and I understand what the people need, even if I don't agree with what they want.
I'm the people's champion who want to let the people have fun with fun, stupid things.
I was standing right over here, as I like to say, giving Dune 3 out of 4 stars.
You're Space Hitler and I'm Space Moses.
There you go. That's good.
Wait, so who? I'm Space Hitler?
Yeah, and I'm Space Moses.
I liked the movie. I don't deserve to be Space Hitler this time.
Yeah, you do.
I mean, I am Space Hitler in the sense that I know what's best for everybody, and I have declared jihad on pretty much everyone.
I never intend to watch this movie again.
No, I don't, but I would probably not hate it if I had to. I'd much rather watch this one than any other movie with the name Dune in it. No, that's not true. I'd rather watch the David Lynch one because at least it's goofy and kind of fun. But I'd rather watch this one than the TV miniseries.
Well,
or the first part of Denis Villeneuve's Dune. I'd certainly rather watch this than any of Dylan Villeneuve's any other movies. I don't know. I kind of enjoyed it on the usual Jake level, you know? It's pretty and it had pretty people and they did things and there was like colors. No, I'm insulting Jake. There was colors on the screen. There was movement. There was sound. Me entertained.
It's a little bit of visual stimulation. It's all Jake needs.
I think that eclipse scene at the beginning bought a lot of goodwill for me. It was like, I feel feelings of being on Arrakis. And if you've given me that, it's like I have got my money's worth already. You kept up your part of the bargain. Whereas Jake didn't go in wanting that. He wanted Space Hitler crushing his enemies.
The bargain is, we're gonna pay off a story. That's the bargain I wanted paid off.
I thought it was a pretty good vibe. I enjoyed the vibe. Sounds like Ben enjoyed the vibe.
I enjoyed the vibe.
And the last third really does. I was pretty annoyed. But I liked it. I really have to recommend, though, folks, watch Wonka. If you want to watch a good Timothée Chalamet movie, I still don't know that that's actually how you pronounce his name. I guess it probably is. It can't be Chalamet.
Chalamet, right?
Chalamet. There you go.
I think.
It's Chalamet.
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 Chalamet. Lahoud Gulai Gisan Abajiba Chalamet. Yeah, watch Wonka. It's great. Okay. Ben, did you say how many stars? How many?
I said 3 out of 4, I think.
Three out of 4, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I give it 3 out of 4. My wife and I were both in the right mood, in a good mood. We saw it together. We had a nice evening. The entire experience of the movie, from getting into the car to eating dinner, like everything was pleasant. You cannot discount how much
context matters.
How much context matters. I think you should. That's why it's sometimes useful to report on context when you're being providing criticism, because if I had seen this movie by myself on the wrong day,
which I did,
which Jake did, if I had done exactly what Jake did, I might be feeling some more of what Jake's feeling.
I saw it by myself on a Saturday afternoon.
Yeah, that's not a, after all of our,
there's some context
after all of our intellectual talk.
I was not happy to be there in the first place.
All of our spiritual, everything, all our insight, basically it boils down to Nathan went on a Friday with his wife. Jake wasted a Saturday by himself. And Ben, what did you do?
I went and saw it late one evening by myself. But I was fine. I was happy to be there. And I think the film does have a good vibe for the first two-thirds.
It really does. Good vibe. Good vibe movie. All right. You're welcome, folks. So ends our positive review. Okay. Goodbye. Until next time.
Lead them to paradise.
Jake just derisively, like, flicked his microphone away. Yeah. All right. But the button I actually meant to push, though, was the context button.
Let me explain. No, there is too much. Let me sum up.
You may think you know what you're dealing with, but believe me, you don't.
Oh, right. It's me?
Yeah.
I'm on?
Yeah.
Whoa.
Quick, hey. People want to know what we think about this movie. Oh,
fine. All right. I'll tell you a little bit about Frank Herbert. Frank Herbert, who was an American writer of science fiction. Interesting fellow. Okay. Born 1920. Died 1986. He was apparently a smart kid. He liked to read books. He had a real good memory. And in his career, he never graduated college, but that didn't stop him from being a successful journalist and even sort of parlaying his successful book writing career into becoming like a university lecturer and stuff and about ecology and all kinds of subjects. He was at World War II as a photographer, but suffered a head injury, and that was the end of that. And he just read all kinds. He read philosophy and psychology and religion and science fiction and political philosophy. All the stuff you can find that feeds into Dune.
Dune.
So he said he read science fiction for like 10 years before submitting his own first story, which he did. He published this serial story that was lit later. You can find now published as a novel. I forget what it's called. It was like this sci-fi novel that predicted there would be fights over oil between nations. So that's the kind of stuff that he was thinking about. And that's part of what makes Dune so interesting. He just is interested in all these giant things, and you feel this massive sense of unopened doors in the massive galaxy that he creates. And that's what makes Dune cool. So he actually, one of the random thing that that he did, he was a speechwriter in the early 1950s for a man named Guy Cordon, who was a Republic senator. It has a famous rule called the Cordon Rule. It's just something like Senate committee reports should talk about how a bill could change current law. They should always include that. This is going to change the law this way. So that's the Cordon Rule, the well-known Cordon Rule. So it's weird that Frank Herbert was a speechwriter for a Republican senator. I thought it was weird.
Yeah.
But he was. And he just did a lot of things and saw a lot of life. He liked to eat mushrooms.
This is what people tuned in for.
That's right. He did. He also did psilocybin.
Which, that's a little more interesting, I guess.
That's where I was going. That's why I laughed. Yes. So he, what can I say? Dune, the book, started out as research for an article on sand dunes in the Pacific Northwest. Herbert was actually born in Tacoma, Washington, where I lived for 10 years. So he was... lived a lot of his life out there.
Number of sci-fi masterpieces written by Ben, zero. What are you thinking?
Number's about to change, Nathan.
Is it really?
No. Okay. I'm lying.
That's worth asking.
I'll consider it, though. I'll consider it. I just need 6 years to research and write my epic novel, which is what Herbert did. And then I didn't know this, but Dune wasn't published as a novel at first. It was published serially. An analog magazine, if you've ever heard of that magazine of science fiction stories. I figured you had. What if our listeners had?
That's like the serious one. That's not like the babes in like space bikinis firing laser guns one. That's like the hard sci-fi. People who really like sci-fi read that magazine.
Yeah, yeah. So he just kept writing and eventually achieved enough commercial success that he could be a full-time writer and wrote a bunch of books. There's a science fiction author, interesting guy named Algis Budrys, who's like a Lithuanian-American dude. And you might, if you've ever heard of anything by this guy, you've heard of his little novel or novelette, Rogue Moon, which is famous. And for some reason, I have read it twice. I despise it. It would make an interesting podcast actually to talk about it and why I hate it. Believe it or not, it would be interesting, but I won't.
Isn't I've read it twice. I despise it. Most Ben Solzer statement of all time.
This is a very Ben Solzer statement.
It's short enough that, anyway, I was curious. Did I really hate this? This is famous. Was it awesome? And why did I hate? Oh, yeah, I hate this.
Man, putting my hand in the paper shredder just was terrible. I lost fingers.
It can't have much as bad, all though, that. Right?
Let me try. No!
Anyway, Algis Budrys is like an intellectual. And so he's a sci-fi writer, but he's an intellectual. And Herbert's around in this crowd.
I did the same thing until we had Francis.
Yeah, I've done it. I've done it many times.
He said that Herbert's knowledge of language and linguistics was, quote, worth at least one PhD and the chair of philology at a good New England college, unquote. So he had a really high opinion of Herbert's self-education. And I don't know, I think when you read Dune, you're like, this guy's read a lot of stuff. Whatever else you want to say about the quality of it as a work of literature, you're like, this guy has thought about a lot of things. There's a lot in the blender here that I've never thought about, or stuff going on beneath the surface, like he's thinking philosophy, he's thinking psychology, he's thinking politics. You're like, what is going on in this novel? So that's Frank Herbert, and he only wrote 6 out of a planned 7 novels. I've read four of those. Through God, Emperor of Dune. Like Nathan mentioned earlier, it gets real debauched. It gets like women using sex to control men in some gross ways and just all kinds of really gross and disgusting and perverse stuff as he writes about his vision for the survival of the human species and the kinds of things that... Anyway, and it's just bizarre.
Yeah, there's also, it seems to me in reading the further books, profoundly uninterested in giving... Like, the things that he liked about Dune are not the same things necessarily that the average reader likes about Dune. Like, there is no action, and I mean no action in several of those later books. Like, there's no – it's like he used the hero's journey and the action scenes and stuff kind of as a spice to make people like his book. But once he had an audience, he's like, actually, what I'm interested in are my political things and sexual things, and I've got stuff I want to say. And so God Emperor of Dune is probably the most egregious example where – you know, Paul Atreides' son, as one has happens, has been transformed into a giant worm.
He did it to himself.
You got to watch out what you do in life. Sometimes you might become a giant sandworm who is the God Emperor of Dune. And then somebody might write a novel about you where you just lecture about politics and sexual politics for the entire novel. And there's like a sort of exciting plot happening way in the background, and then I think at the end a bridge blows up and some people die. But basically, the novel is just monologues by this worm about politics.
I don't remember it that well.
That's not me being funny.
That's all I've ever heard about it.
That's actually what it is.
It's kind of amazing. It has such a weird science fiction backdrop that it still is compelling in an odd way because there are so many strange ideas. I mean, I know, like you say, the plot's in the background, but he's throwing so many ideas at you.
Yeah.
In terms of what's happening.
Hey, I made it through 4 books. Like, it's always interesting.
Right. Yeah, yeah. It's not boring, at least, I could say not boring in a traditional sense.
Right.
It's weird. So I never, after that, like, I think what's weird is that I read God Emperor before I read books 2 and 3. So at some point, for some reason, after reading God Emperor of Dune, I went back to books 2 and 3. I don't know what motivated me after that. But I never went forward past, I never went to 5 and 6. So, here's this famous Herbert quote that I think Jake Gardy might have cited in our preview podcast of this episode. All governments suffer a recurring problem. Power attracts pathological personalities. It is not that power corrupts, but that it is magnetic to the corruptible. Such people have a tendency to become drunk on violence, a condition to which they're quickly addicted. That's kind of a cool quote. It's pretty good.
Seems pretty insightful, I'd say.
Yeah, seems pretty insightful. And he had a lot of insights like that. And, oh, another weird thing about Dune is that it popularized the use of the term ecology. Like, ecology was just a niche term. It wasn't in the sort of lingo of the culture. And because of Dune, it was.
Dune has been huge for the green movement, and it's not really remembered that way. But if you actually do the research, like, Herbert cared about ecology, and this book was profoundly impactful in making a lot of people care about it.
Yeah. And there's other random stuff. I just went down a rabbit hole of a couple of little things that he was interested in and reading about when he was writing. I mean, and throughout his career, not just in that one book, but he was interested in this thing that still exists in some form called general semantics. But at the time, this guy named Alfred Korzybski, who was a Polish-American guy, and the general semantics is not the field of semantics. General semantics is this weird, like, metaphysical, like, psychological, almost self-help kind of philosophical movement, and it's weird. So you have heard of this guy's most famous slogan, the map is not the territory. That's from Korzybski in general semantics. But what he means is that the person is not what you call them. You can't access them with words. You had better be careful that you think of words as this really limited tool you can use to get only part of reality, because you're not really accessing the person. You're not really accessing the flower. You're not really accessing the sky. And so you better stop yourself and pull yourself back and realize that there's a veil, there's a wall between you and the real world, and you can get some reality, but not much. And so you ought to be humble, and you ought to become aware of your states of consciousness that lead you to make judgments. And if you're going to say, that guy's a bad guy, what you should say is, that guy's a bad guy, etc., so that everyone realizes there's things about the man that aren't just bad, and you're not saying them. I listened to a podcast about this today, and I was like, you guys are goobers. So that's general semantics. So it's like, become aware of your states of consciousness, believe in this. It's a whole, like, theory of reality that's not quite a religion, basically, but it's quasi-religious. So he was thinking about that as he wrote Dune. He was reading a guy named Thomas Szasz. Have you heard of Thomas Szasz?
Yes.
Thomas Szasz wrote the book The Myth of Mental Illness. So he kind of leads into the anti-psychiatry movement, and he's like, yeah, mental illness is this metaphor. It's too malleable. You can't really trust these definitions. There's no biological test you can make for diagnosing someone with schizophrenia. So it's a tool of control, and you ought to be really careful. And if you're going to use psychiatric treatment, it should not be coerced. So that's Thomas Szasz. I like all of the stuff that I just said. There's more to him than that. But so Herbert's in all these things, and he's reading all this stuff. And he writes all these weird books to explore his ideas and his ideas of sexual politics. And then he dies in 1986, 2 years, is that right? 2 years after Lynch's Dune comes out. And Lynch's Dune fails more or less in the U.S., but it's a big success in Europe. The critics like it. The people like it. It makes money. It's like, yes, got some extra cachet now. And then 2 years later, he dies, leaving his Dune saga unfinished. And then many years later, his son Brian Herbert apparently finds thousands and thousands and thousands of pages in a lockbox with his dad's plan for Dune 7. So Brian, I'm sorry. I don't know. I'm not ever probably going to bother opening one of the Brian Herbert Dune books in my life. So Brian Herbert is like, well, I'm not just going to finish book 7 or finish book 7 in 2 volumes. Which he does established sci-fi author named Kevin Anderson. But Brian Herbert and Kevin J. Anderson, they've written so far 17 Dune books. So they've got a little cottage industry of Dune books and the only rabbit hole I went down on them is reading about the plots and kind of where things go and where things end. And I was like, yeah, I don't need to read this.
Ain't gonna be nowhere satisfying.
That's cool. That's cool, yeah.
That's cool.
It's real cool. It's real cool, bro. So his dad wrote 6 and he's written 17.
Spice must flow.
I think that's pretty funny. But hey, maybe they're great books. I don't think that they are. So that's a little bit about Frank Herbert. Weirdo.
Weirdo.
Interesting guy. Would have been probably cool to have a conversation with.
Maybe. Well, yeah, probably. I've seen him in interviews. He's interesting.
Have you? I've never watched a clip of him.
Well, there is some context.
Let me explain. No, there is too much. Let me sum up.
You may think you know what you're dealing with,
yep.
But believe me, you don't.
Yep. More context on the way.
More context on the way.
Hold on, folks. Let me dig up some more. Hold on.
No, I will say David Lynch, of course, made a movie that was not very beloved here and not very beloved by David Lynch. Taken out of his control and all that. And, you know, it's got some points. It's also got a very intentionally ugly aesthetic to it, and it's just weird. And then there was a TV miniseries in the early 2000s, kind of a sci-fi thing that a lot of people like, but it's pretty low rent. And then you finally got Denis Villeneuve.